show up for your jobs, you're not going to have a job. You should treat college like work. But what do I know? I'm just an old bald guy. All right, lady and gentlemen. I've got a lot to do, little time to do it. I do have some updates, but I'll share them at the end because we know that there are habitual tardy people in this class, so we'll give them a chance to show up. So class. Right where we left off, talking about the development of fascism, or rather totalitarianism. And again, this would be a political system that would arise as a result of the destruction of World War I, and it would be based on socialistic attitudes that would allow political parties to take over control of states and basically impose total control on society and the people therein. That's why it's called totalitarianism. There would be three major forms that would appear. There would be Stalinism, which we don't have time to talk about. There would be fascism, which we're going to talk about today. And of course, there would be National Socialism, which I will give you an update on that when we get to the end of class. So, without further ado, Italy, even though Italy was originally part of the Triple Alliance, allied with the Austro-Hungarian Empire and Germany, we know they declared in neutrality when the war began because they felt that it wasn't Austria or Germany getting attacked, but rather it was Austria trying to attack Serbia that led to the war. But they were bribed and they would eventually go into the war on the side of the Entente. So technically, they were one of the winners. But they suffered almost as bad as the losers. Northern Italy, the portion that bordered the Austro-Hungarian Empire, saw multiple attacks by the Austrians. And again, in terms of the battlefields of World War I, the campaigns in the Alps were just insane. If you ever have a chance to look up pictures of what the Italians and the Austrians had to deal with, they literally were fighting on mountains. They had to bring like their guns up on back, like artillery on their backs. They had to use hoists. There was constant avalanches and like people just died because they were fighting on the side of mountains. So it was brutal. Plus, their casualties were unbelievably high. They suffered 700,000 deaths and didn't get anything for it other than an economy that was completely destroyed. Their money, the lira, depreciated 2/3 of its value. So their dollars was worth 1/3 of what it was pre-war. There was little food. There were rising prices. There was inflation, massive employment. Their trade had been disrupted. And they didn't have enough to recover. So it got really bad, descending almost into chaos. The Italian people claimed that they were victims of what they referred to as a mutilated victory. In other words, yeah, great, we won, but it was a Pyrrhic victory. You know, we ended up losing in the long run. And so what did people do? They took to the streets. There were violent strikes, violent riots. People were out of control everywhere. Workers seized factories. There was crime, assaults on the streets. And there was squatting going on, just like that's going on in our country with all the illegal immigrants. And there was nothing, it seemed, that the government could do. So this caused people to rise up and engage in like vigilantism. They would attempt to do something about it. The first group to strike in Italy were the nationalists. True right-wing nationalists. The leader of this movement was Gabriele D'Annunzio. He was a veteran. He had fought in World War I. He came from a upper middle class family, well-to-do. Prior to the war, he was an adventurer. He explored like the Brazilian rainforests and, you know, did expeditions on the Nile and in Africa. But after the war, he was so disgusted at how incompetent the government was, he decided to take action. He would gather together a group of veterans, about 3,000 of them, and would actually go to war and seize a city. They would seize the city of Fiume, which today is Rijeka, which is in Croatia. The reason why they attacked this city was this was one of the territory, part of the territory, that Italy was promised to get Italy to go in the war. But Woodrow Wilson and Georges Clemenceau and David Lloyd George basically told Vittorio Orlando, no, you're not getting it. So when the diplomacy, the negotiations didn't work, D'Annunzio and his group took matters into their own hands.
Are they not like bound by contract or anything? Like they can just promise something and
yeah.
not give it?
Yeah.
Is that like a war crime
reason? No.
Oh.
Yeah, I know, right? It's just not right. Because if they were honest with Italy and told Italy up front they weren't going to get anything, they never would have gone into the war. But if I want you to do something for me, I'll promise you everything imaginable. So, yeah, crazy. Crazy. But that was one of the things that he was angry about. Again, 700,000 Italians died for the promise of getting this land, only to have the Allies say, oh, too bad. So what does he do? He gets his veterans, they take up guns, and they go to war. And they took the city. Now, ironically, the population in the city was mostly Italians. So when the army went to lay siege to the city, most of the people in the city rose up and joined with the nationalists. They wanted to be in Italy, too. They didn't want to be with the Croatians in Yugoslavia. But chaos would break out. So much so that the Allies would send troops in. Americans and British and French soldiers were landed to basically drive the nationalists out of this city. But D'Annunzio, because he had most of the people on his side, actually fought off their former allies. And he created what became known as the Free State of Fiume. Well, while this was going on, the Allies kept contacting Rome and saying to the Italian government, why are your people doing this? Do something about it. And what did the Italian government do?
I don't know.
In the end, there would be 5 years of negotiation. And what they ended up deciding to do is to split the territory in half. Half of it went to Yugoslavia. Half of it ended up being merged with Italy. And the majority Italian population were allowed to move into Italy. But still, we're talking outright vigilantism. Well, the problem was, is that there were other people watching this. You know, it's one of the problems that I have, what has been allowed to happen in our country over the course of your lifetime. There was a point in time when criminals actually used to get arrested, tried, and if found guilty, sent to prison for doing the smallest things. Because the idea was, is if you punish the small things when you can punish them, you're going to prevent the big things. But now they don't even do that. So that's one of the reasons why our country's out of control. And it's not good. Innocent people are getting killed. Heard about, again, I think it was up in Lawrence. Might be Lowell. One of the two L cities. Like a 6-year-old kid got shot by a gangbanger. You know, it's incredible. It's awful. But that's what happens. If the government doesn't respond, then people think they can do whatever they want. Well, one of the people to watch was none other than Benito Mussolini. Prior to World War I, Mussolini was one of the leading members of the Italian Socialist Party. He was a political journalist. He was the editor of one of the leading socialist newspapers. And he was an agitator, just like Lenin or Trotsky. He called for class conflict and a Marxist revolution. In other words, he wanted the proletariat to rise up and destroy the bourgeoisie. But he made one mistake. When Italy joined the war, the Italian Socialist Party was against Italian entry. But Mussolini made the mistake of saying, no, this could be a good opportunity. So he actually got kicked out of the party. But he didn't get any softer. In fact, the exact opposite happened. While pre-war he was a revolutionary socialist, he realized, as he learned from fighting in World War I, being stuck in trenches with guys from all different classes in parts of Italy, that the only way to achieve victory with the revolution was through nationalism. So, the key difference? His movement was a revolution that involved all social classes. Not like the Marxist revolutionary, which only talks about the poor rising up and killing the rich. Well, ironically, because of his stance, he was actually able to get donations from Italian arms manufacturers that made donations to his political movement, as well as other war-related businesses, because he was coming out seeming like a patriot. And what does he do with that money? Well, he started his own a nationalist newspaper, which was Il Popolo d'Italia. And he began calling for the overthrow of the government and the establishment of a new type of regime. Now, FYI, during the war, he also received money from the British MI5. MI5 is the British version of the CIA. So he was engaged in counter-national espionage. But that's money that's going into his bank account. Also during the war is where he formulated what would become known as fascism. Fascism was a new form of socialism that balanced Marxist revolutionary theory with traditional values. So the focus would be on an Italian revolution, a revolution that would be good for all Italian people. Also, the nation would be ruled by a new nationalistic elite. So the old nobility would be gone, but rather this new party-focused government would be created. And it wouldn't be democratic. No. Once the revolution occurred and they took over power, they would stay in power. And what would they do? Well, they would use the government for the benefit of everybody. So the existing class structure would remain the same. But the goal would be to focus on the good of the country. Kind of similar to what John F. Kennedy said in his famous State of the Union address, when he said, ask not what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country. He demanded citizens perform civil service, work for the good of the country, for the community. But one of the biggest moves that he made is he called for the government taking over all avenues of education to promote the ideology of the movement. So the kids would not be educated, the kids would be indoctrinated. And it's easy to do, because what do kids know? Right. But if a teacher tells you it's true, they're most likely to sit back and say, okay. Now, FYI, there was a little 19th century racism present as well. But it wasn't necessarily saying that the Italians were, you know, the best people ever. But rather, it was more along the lines of the social Darwinistic ideas, that the Italians were among the better people and thus they could exploit the inferior people. But fascism was not as racist as National Socialism, the ideology of the Nazis. All right, any questions on fascism? All right, when the war ended, he decided to form his first group. And what he would do is he would organize basically his own paramilitary organization. This group was known as the Fasci di Combattimento, or Band of Combat. The members would call themselves the Fascisti, which in English would be fascist. The Fascisti were Roman symbols of military power. So back when Rome was present, a legionnaire that served with distinction, he would get a special bundle, usually containing some arrows, maybe a special sword, and some wheat stalks. So by calling themselves this honorable band of combat, they were linking their movement to the historic past when Italy was a superpower, which also is something that totalitarians do. But its platform, extreme socialism. Mussolini would actually run as the Lenin of Italy. Because by now, everyone in the world knew who Lenin was because he managed to successfully take over Russia. So his campaign was leftist. It was against the church, which was a big no-no. It also was anti-monarchy. The funny thing was, is he attempted to oust socialists, even the Socialist Party. So he called for government control of everything. Government control of the economy. Government control of schools. Government control of private lives. And he got some support, particularly from people who were unemployed. But it wasn't a strong message. And in fact, in the 1919 elections, Mussolini did so bad that he didn't even receive a single vote in his own hometown. So, after he failed in his first attempt to get into power, he decided to reevaluate, reassess, change, and adapt. The biggest thing that he wanted to do was take advantage of all the strikes and the riots. Because as the old saying goes, never let a crisis go to waste. So what does he do? Well, he realizes if his fascists appear to be the thugs, no one's going to vote for him. So he would separate. He would allow the fascists to be the politicians, but the soldiers would be their own unit. The squadrizi. Or in full Italian, the Milizano Volontiero per la Sucera National. Abbreviated as the squadrizi. This would be a paramilitary organization. The veterans would get to wear uniforms. These uniforms made of the famous black shirts. They were armed. They had weapons. They had rank. And they would be used to attack other political parties. So if a riot broke out, the squadrizi would show up and they'd start bashing heads. They also organized their own protests. Protesting those forces that were responsible for the chaos. See, they were clever. And again, this is something that the idiots on the college campuses of all the chaos that's going on right now don't get. People don't care about their little protests. I mean, do any of you care what these elite rich kids on Ivy League college campuses are bitching about?
No.
Well, one of the regardless of the message, one of the funniest things that I saw was there was a reporter noting that all of the tents that they're using are all like top of the line tents, and some of the protesters are there with their Coach bags, and they're all with their fancy brands. They're showing up in BMWs. I mean, who cares? Because at the end of the day, the average person who actually has a job, that has to go to work, that has to pay their bills, take care of their family, they have no time for these little yuppie kids and their protests. So what's the attitude of the most blue-collar American worker about those strikes? They want the police to go in and arrest them all. Well, the police aren't allowed to do that. The same situation was going on in Italy. For whatever reason, the government wouldn't deploy the police. So guess what the squadrizi would do? They would show up and they'd break the strikes. They'd break the rioters. And to the average Italian, suddenly they were the heroes. Because they were doing what the government would not do. And they went after the groups that people didn't like. They attacked the socialists. They attacked the unionists. And the more violent they got, the more popular they got. Because you know what Mussolini realized? Stop talking politics. He figured out after 1919 that he could not talk about his socialist ideas. Because socialism divides people. So instead, focus on what most people want. A job. The ability to move safely down the streets. The ability to feed their families. And that became their message. And ultimately, what helped them is what I already said. As the Squadrizi were going out cracking heads, the government did nothing. So these guys became the heroes. Why? Well, it was kind of like the enemy of my enemy is my friend. The regime apparently was more terrified about a communist revolution than they were about vigilantism. So the government kind of said to the Squadrizi, go for it. And as a result, membership would grow. So much so that in 1921, Mussolini rebranded his movement and would create a new national party, the Partito Nazionale Fascista, the National Fascist Party. And what does he do? He kept the socialism, but he cloaked it in conservatism. Instead of talking about smashing and destroying and government takeovers, no, he talked about making Italy great. Italy with this long historic past, that Italy should be considered a national power. This made him more and more popular. And as he got more popular, he started focusing on the things that people don't like. The average person does not want the government taking over by socialists. Because just raw socialists are like, don't like the Democrats in our country. Like all of the stuff, if you're paying attention to the news, probably not. But like Joe Biden wants to ban gas stoves. Joe Biden wants to force you to have electric cars. Joe Biden wants to end gasoline. You know, that's socialism. When the government tells you what to do, that's not freedom. Well, most people don't want to be told what to do. So Mussolini figured this out. I'm going to stop talking about socialism, and I'll talk about those themes that the people appreciate. And more and more and more, he started getting more and more popular. And then, he would become an international superstar. When in 1921, all of the unions in Italy made an agreement to implement a national strike to increase benefits for the factory workers. Before the strike could launch, the fascists got word and they broke up the unions. They assaulted the leaders. They raided union offices. Literally took their money. This would make him not only a national hero, but an international hero. He was praised as an innovator, even in American newspapers, for his boldness to protect the Italian people over special interests. And then he did something which on paper makes no sense. But he decided to take advantage of his sudden fame. Instead of waiting, in 1922, with 50,000 fascists, he marched on Rome, making it very similar to what the ancient Roman emperors used to do when they had their triumphs. He paraded through the city as being a hero to the Italian people. And thousands turned out and cheered. Ironically, the parliament told the king to call out the army and shoot him. But the king decides not to act. The reason being is he agreed with Mussolini that the socialists and the unions needed to be crushed, that Italy should be great. So instead of arresting him for committing assault, battery, crime, arson, what does the king do? He brings him into the government and appoints him as prime minister. And at this point, the first totalitarian regime would be put in place. So again, he didn't take over power through a revolution. He was brought into power. But as prime minister, he had tremendous influence. And he would end up creating a fascist state. First, he would just take control of everything. Now, the weird thing was is that he didn't use any singular ideology. For Mussolini, it was all about making sure he stayed in power. So, for example, he got rid of elections. He canceled elections. And he basically shut down the parliament. He also got rid of, like, local governments. Everything came from the national government. He crushed free speech, crushed freedom of the press, and created special tribunals where if Mussolini suspected you were opposed to his state, you could actually be dragged before the tribunal. No lawyers, no trial by juries. Just silenced. He also used the executive branch, the cabinet, to run the state. So the cabinet has all of the heads of all of the different government agencies. So there's the foreign ministry, there's the treasury, there's the army. Well, as prime minister, he could put in whoever he wanted into those offices. So all he did was put fascists in all of those positions. And he used the executive branch to run the state. He also manipulated the Catholic Church. Obviously, the Catholic Church, the heart of the Catholic Church is in Rome, in the midst of the capital of the city. Catholics, the Catholic Church itself, was not necessarily fond of Mussolini, but Mussolini figured out how to basically win them over with bribes. And in 1928, he signed what is known as the Lateran Treaty, which, among other things, created the Vatican. In case you were not aware, the Vatican is legally a city-state. So it's a country in its own right. It has its own government, and it's governed by the Pope. Well, it exists because of Mussolini. Mussolini also gave to the Catholic Church, Catholicism was named as the official state religion, and all people in Italy received mandatory religious instruction. So there was no separation of church and state, but rather the church was controlled by the state. And so if you were an Italian student and you went to any grade level of school, you got Catholicism. CCD, from K to college. And the fascists also would implement what today is known as state capitalism. This, by the way, is what we have in our country. This was created in our country post-World War II. Actually, began during the Great Depression with the New Deal. This is where the government takes control of the economy but uses corporations to do the government's bidding. So, the government set wages, the government set working hours, prices were controlled, but strikes were made illegal. So, what does this mean? Well, the government could basically control whatever items were produced. And they did so through regulations. And by the way, the same thing exists in our country. If your parents own a business, can they do whatever they want with that business? Or do they have to get a license before they open the business? Are they subject to constant regulation, taxation? Does the government tell them what they can sell, who they can sell it to? Well, guess what, my friends? We don't live in a free country anymore. DC has taken over everything. We live in a state capitalistic society. And by the way, there was no resistance because he did bread and circus. The old tactic that the Roman emperors used to use. Because he constantly cloaked everything he was doing in the glory of the ancient past, to which the people celebrated. We're going to make Italy great again. And the people say, yay. But here's the funny thing. If you ever have time to study Rome, Rome was not this hippie, folkish commune. Rome literally was born of blood and violence. Rome became Rome by basically conquering the Mediterranean world and destroying anyone who stood in their way. So one of the weird things is Mussolini was kind of projecting what his intentions were. Once he had complete control, his intentions was to take Italy to war. So that way they could glorify themselves as being true descendants of ancient Rome. And the people had no say. Questions? Well, it wasn't just Italy that was suffering. Germany was also suffering. But the regime of the Kaiser was gone. And in its place was a republic known as the Weimar Republic. Weimar, because this is the location, the city in Germany where the new government was based. So they moved the government out of Berlin. Like Italy, post-World War I, Germany was a mess. Revolutions were breaking out all across the country. The communists would rise up in Berlin. There would be socialists in Munich. In the city of Kiel, the entire navy mutinied. All of the 26 kings that were in Germany were forced to abdicate along with the Kaiser. And the economy was a mess. 4 years of war, deaths of millions, left their economy completely shattered. Plus the Allies, the Brits in particular, were still doing the blockade. choking the Germans to get them to sign the Treaty of Versailles. And speaking of Versailles, we did what that treaty did to Germany. 15% of the farmland gone, most of their industry gone, coal, iron reserves gone, colonies gone. Oh, and reparations. Germany was half dead on the ground, and it didn't have the strength to stand up. And on top of that, they had to make a new government. They had to make a new government in the midst of the chaos. Because the old government was gone. November 9th, 1918, the Kaiser abdicated. As I think I told you, he would be allowed to flee to the Netherlands. He would receive amnesty and he would live there until his death in 1941. But power would be transferred to a politician. Frederick Ebert, one of the leaders of the Social Democrat Party. Yeah, I said it right. Now, here's the thing. He was a socialist, but he was not a revolutionary socialist. He was a moderate. So, meaning, he was okay with some governmental regulations, but he never advocated for a complete totalitarian state. Instead, he wanted to create a liberal democratic society. But to rule, there was not just two political parties like in our country. In Germany, there were 20. So in order for Ebert to get anything done, he had to make a coalition, an alliance of sorts, to get enough seats in the government to allow him to make decisions. So you're literally starting off with nothing. And in the midst of this, a revolution did break out, led by a group that would be known as the Spartacists. The Spartacists were the most radical of the communists in Germany. They actually had their own political party, the Kommunistische Partei Deutschlands, the German Communist Party. And the Spartacists were the most violent of those people. They literally wanted to do to Germany what Lenin was doing to Russia. They wanted to burn everything down and rebuild it in their image. And initially, it seemed like the ruling coalition could not do anything about it. That was until they made a fateful decision, which would have huge implications on Germany and is one of the factors that would start Germany moving towards World War II. The Chancellor, who would become president in 1919, was desperate. And he would make a fateful decision. He would ally himself with groups that were organizing throughout Germany, known as the Freikorps. The Freikorps were militias, like gangs, made up of veterans who were disgusted by the communists. Amazingly, when the veterans left the Western Front and went back to Germany, they were allowed to bring their guns with them. So what did these groups do? Well, they organized themselves in military units, and they literally would go to war against the communists. And there was nothing Ebert could do about it other than basically say, go for it. To make matters even more interesting, most of the officers of the Freikorps were members of the new National Guard, the Reichswehr. So while the soldiers had their guns, their connections with the Reichswehr allowed the Freikorps to get machine guns and bullets and grenades. So ultimately, the little protesters didn't stand a chance. Now, technically, the army could have, with the Freikorps, overthrow the government. They could have done it with ease, because there was nothing the new government could do about it. But Ebert made a deal with the devil. He promised the leaders of the Reichswehr guaranteed funding if they supported the government. Bless you. Bless you. Remember, guys and now gals, plural, always say God bless you to someone who sneezes. Because the ancient Greeks believed that if you sneezed and you don't say God bless you, that person's soul could leave their body. Well, that comes from the ancient Greeks. And we don't want poor Ashley falling over dead, being a soulless carcass. All right, so, because the army knew that they had guaranteed funding, the army would basically be allowed to do whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted. But when you make a deal with the devil, you gotta learn how to dance. In the end, the leftists, they didn't stand a chance. They didn't stand a chance. Just like the little hippie protesters on the campus wouldn't stand a chance if a bunch of Marine Corps veterans would have gone in the middle of the city and shut things down. It would be over like that. And it would be funny. I would love to watch the videos. I would just laugh. Like, have you seen the little video clips of the protesters, like down in Texas, that the police are actually starting to break up? There was one guy that was probably about your size, and he was sitting there crying, "Don't do this to me!" I just laughed. Except, by the way, the leftists in Germany, they ended up dead. Well, once the leftists were crushed, this would allow the new ruling coalition to make a new government by making a new constitution. This new government would be liberal in the traditional sense of the word, like 19th century liberals like Thomas Jefferson. So, at quick glance, it had separation of powers. So there would be a legislative branch, there would be an executive branch, there would be a judicial branch. The legislative branch was like ours. It was bicameral. There was an upper house and a lower house. Their Senate was called the Reichsrat. Their House of Representatives was called the Reichstag. There also would be an executive branch. But it would be different than ours. They did have a president who would be elected by the people. But the president's job was just to be like an elected king. So he was the commander-in-chief. He was the chief of state. But the president didn't really have any government real related specific duties. That was controlled by the chancellor. The chancellor was the head politician. But here's the catch. The president was elected by the people, but the chancellor was appointed by the president. So if the people didn't like the chancellor, it didn't matter. It only mattered if the president liked him. Oh, there we go. I didn't realize that was a click. There also would be a cabinet. And the cabinet was made up of all of the different ministers, the heads of department. So, president appoints the chancellor. The job of the chancellor is to run the cabinet and basically make sure that the laws of the state are enforced. And there would be a separate judiciary branch, like I mentioned. But you know what they didn't have? They didn't have the power of judicial review. Anyone know what that is? Judicial review is one of the things that makes our courts powerful. Because in our country, a court can declare a law to be unconstitutional. Well, in Germany, they didn't have that power. If a law was a law, they had to enforce it. So this means the government could basically pass any laws that they wanted, and they always would be constitutional. And speaking of the Constitution, it had one of the lengthiest, most detailed Bill of Rights out of any Constitution that I've read. Our Bill of Rights in the U.S. Constitution has 10 articles in it. Theirs had 72. And it was full-blown socialist, or democratic socialist, I guess you could say. All people had equality before the law. All of the privileges of the nobles were removed. There would be free but compulsory education. All Germans had to go to school by law until the age of 18. You weren't allowed to drop out. There was right to privacy, freedom of the press, etc., etc. But you know it was not a guaranteed right? The right to keep and bear arms. That was controlled by legislation. Because guess what the Nazis would do when they got into power? You know, tweak the law so the Jews couldn't have guns. But as complete and lengthy as this Constitution is, it had a series of flaws that the Nazis would use to get into power. The first flaw was their election system. Their Reichstag, their legislature, had delegates selected through proportional representation elections. Meaning, in our system, it's winner take all. So you have a Democrat running against a Republican, or a Republican against an independent. And whoever gets the most votes wins. And the loser gets nothing. Well, in Germany, you didn't vote for the candidate. You voted for the party. So, as long as the party got 1% of the vote, they could get seats. But the party picked who would sit in those seats, not the people. In a country that had, at its height, I think it was the 1924 election, they had like 36 political parties that were on the ballot. Well, this basically meant you could have the most extreme parties imaginable. Because they could get in government just by capturing 1% of the vote. I'll tell you, and this is going to sound crazy, but I bet you in this system, I could make a anti-kitten party. A party whose sole platform was to kill all kittens. And I bet you I could get 1% of the vote. I bet you I could do that. And if you could get 1% of the vote, you could get seats in the legislature, and you could get involved in the lawmaking process. So, in order to rule, you had to have a coalition. You had to piece together a bunch of political parties. And if the ruling coalition could not govern and it broke apart, the whole system would break down. Next, as I mentioned, another huge problem. Just mention this. The army was outside of control of the government. Because of Ebert's promise to the Reichswehr to get the Free Corps to crush the communists, they actually put in, I think it's Article 30. I don't remember where exactly it is. There's actually a line in the Constitution that says the military will receive a guaranteed, I think it's like 10% of government revenues. So if the Constitution says the army is going to guaranteed, no matter what, get paid, they don't have to listen to the politicians. Plus, the soldiers were not required to take an oath of office to the government. Their oath was to the German people. So what does that mean? Well, it was up to them to decide how are they going to defend the German people, and which German people are they going to defend? Our Constitution, by the way, has civilian control over the military for that reason. And then there's a couple of articles I want you to know by number. Article 48. This clause gave the president the power to suspend the Constitution. This was the martial law clause. The wording of the article is as follows. The president shall suspend any and all articles of the Constitution if public safety and the order of the Reich is considerably disturbed or endangered. What the heck does that mean? Considerably disturbed or endangered. Well, you can't get much more subjective than that. Who decides if the Reich is disturbed or endangered? One person. Just the president. And if the president decides there's a problem, he can suspend the entire Constitution. That means all of the rights and all the protections are gone. And if the president uses Article 48, he can kick out the Reichstag. He can call for new elections. FYI, it would happen 5 times once the Great Depression started. From 1930 to 1933. They had 5 Reichstag elections. The irony is the Reichstag is supposed to serve 4-year terms. So there's only supposed to be an election every 4 years. But if you have 5 elections in 3 years, I'm thinking about how chaotic our country is going to get, you know, once summertime rolls around and the presidential election gets clearer. Our country couldn't handle 5 national elections in 3 years. We'd end up killing each other. And if that wasn't bad enough, the chancellor was more powerful than the president. Anything that the president did, the chancellor had to sign off on. But it wasn't the other way around. The chancellor could basically do what he wanted. The chancellor controlled the cabinet, which meant he controlled all of the executive departments, not the president. And there was no set term. Like I said, the chancellor wasn't elected. He was appointed. And he could stay there for the rest of his life if the president wanted to keep him. And finally, if there was a vacancy in the presidency, the chancellor could fill in. So the chancellor could become the president. And it was up to him to decide when the next presidential election would be. So guess what Chancellor Adolf Hitler did when President Paul von Hindenburg died in August of 1934? He merged the chancellery and the presidency. He declared himself to be Führer. And he said, we'll have an election when I decide to. And it never happened. And as I said, no constitutional, no judicial review. So in our country, if the vice president tried doing something like that, the Supreme Court would get involved and they would declare the vice president to be engaging in an unconstitutional act. And then Congress could impeach them. And the Senate could vote to remove them. You know, so there could be consequences. But not in the German system. Their court system was weak. So, when I talk about Hitler on Thursday, this is how he came to power. He used the system against the system. He did nothing illegal. The Nazis didn't come to power through a revolution. They used the laws to entrench themselves. Questions? There was no opportunity to, because again, you're dealing with the post-war world. Everyone was dealing with chaos. England was potentially facing a revolution. France was having problems. So when the war ended, there was, oh, plus you got the Soviet Union being created in the Russian Civil War. So there literally was chaos everywhere.
So it was basically each one for himself.
Yep. Figure out how to fix the problem. But if you think about it, I'm telling you the end game. I'm telling you how Hitler came to be in power. But when this system was made, nobody did what I just did for you. Put all of the flaws together and tell you how they were used against the system. Because no one at the time thought this was a possibility. Just like, and this is going to be a really scary analogy, and I hopefully you don't offend any of you. Just like nobody before thought that some crazy jihadists would take control of a passenger plane and fly it into buildings. Nothing like that had ever happened before. No one thought of it. But now everyone's aware of it. Because you know what the Islamic terrorists used to do? They used to hijack the planes and hold the people for ransom. Well, the same thing. All they're doing is making a constitution. They're doing the same thing that other countries are doing. Everything is based on votes and everyone thinks it's great. But when you put them all together, scary stuff. Make sense? All right. So now let's do as much of this as we can and then I got to talk to you for a few minutes. Right out of the gates, Weimar faced problems after problems after problems. Of course, the biggest problem was Versailles. The Germans were crippled economically, socially, politically. To make matters worse, both the left and the right hated the Versailles Treaty. And on the extreme right, they claim that the Weimar government betrayed the Germans by signing the Treaty of Versailles. So, right out of the gates, the government was deemed to be illegitimate. So, half the country would not follow the government, no matter what they said. And by the way, if a government is not viewed as legitimate, It really has no power because people are going to resist. And you can't fix problems if half the country is willing to fight the other half of the country. So what would end up playing out again? You would have extreme rightist groups form. You would have extreme leftist groups form. And their politics were battling one another. And the economy? There was no economy. Their economy was shattered. They had inflation. They had debt. And to make matters worse, there were Allied troops in Germany occupying the Ruhr region, which is where the factories were. Because what the Allies were doing was they were extracting reparations. They were using German factories and German resources to make things that were put on trains and shipped back to France or Belgium or England. So what was actually being produced for Germany was not even being produced for the German people. So there was problem after problem after problem. But it took a couple of years, but there would be an innovative politician that would stabilize things. In 1923, a man by the name of Gustav Stresemann was appointed chancellor. He was a brilliant economist, and he figured out a way how to fix the economy. And how did he do it? Well, first, he got rid of the currency. The old Reichsmark was so inflated, I kid you not, one German mark was equal, sorry, strike that, one U.S. dollar was equal, I think, at the height of inflation to 1 billion marks. So, actually, I went to the bank. I forgot I had money. So if I went to Germany with just one of these, I could have 20 billion marks. But that wasn't rich. If I had 20 billion marks, I'd be lucky if I could get a sandwich. Because that's what happens during inflation. And by the way, speaking of inflation, I went to Walmart the other day, and I went to go get a gallon of milk, $7. $7 for a gallon of milk at Walmart. I actually almost vomited. I was disgusted. But welcome to Bidenomics. All right, anyways. So, we're going to get rid of the old currency because it's worthless. But notice, Renten. The root of the dollar, their dollar was a mark. The basis, the value that would back these are government land that would be leased to foreign companies. So our dollar is supposed to be backed by gold. It's not. We don't really have any gold anymore. But what made the U.S. dollar so strong was supposedly how much gold we had in Fort Knox. But they kept printing and printing and printing and printing and printing. Now our dollars aren't even worth what the paper they're printed on. So in order for our dollars to have something of value, they have to have something behind it that is valuable. And right now there's nothing. Well, Stresemann realized no one's going to want our money if our money's worth less. Like literally worthless. So we're going to use government lands. We're going to lease it out to foreign companies. They're going to come in and they're going to pay the government rent, and suddenly we have income. And that's going to be the valuation of our money. He also downsized the government. He reduced the government labor force by 25%. FYI, do you realize that we have 2.5 million government employees working for Washington, D.C.? That does not include all of the government workers that work for the states or the towns. In Massachusetts, their government workers, I think it's one government worker for every 65 people. It's just insane. one of the reasons why Massachusetts is so expensive, because we have so many government employees. Well, the only way to reduce costs is to lay people off. And that's what he did. So, a new money that has value, cut government spending, and then increase taxes. And for a couple of months, the economy fixed itself. But unfortunately, he did screw up. He made one bad mistake. In November 1923, in the city of Munich, a revolution took place. And it started in a beer hall. And the instigator was none other than Adolf Hitler. But Stresemann was so distracted by trying to fix the country, he did not call the army out to crush Hitler. Now, as it turned out, it wasn't necessary because the city and the state government took care of it. But because he did nothing, he was accused of being a sympathizer, and so they voted him out of office. So, I got to explain this. So the Reichstag basically said we can't work for him, with him, so the president fired him. Just to make it clear. All right. Now in the end, Stresemann would not be done with the government. He would be brought back and he would spend the rest of his life working as foreign minister. And in doing so, he actually helped Germany stabilize internationally. So to go to Ernest's question, instead of allowing the chaos to continue in Germany, Stresemann helped bring Germany into the world of nations. First, he negotiated what became known as the Dawes Plan. This was a sustainable reparations payment. So Germany promised to make $1 billion of payments annually. So at least the Allies could get paid off like they were supposed to. He also worked on a non-aggression pact. Germany actually made an alliance known as the Locarno Pact, where he allied Germany with Great Britain, France, Belgium, and Italy, in which all of these nations pledged not to attack one another, that they always would be allies. And Stresemann got Germany into the League of Nations. So again, they were seen as equals on the world stage. The last click is this. And as a result of Stresemann's effort, the German economy would rebound. But of course, as you will see, there would be chaos in 1929. But we're going to have to hold off on that one. So now, this is what I got to say now that most of you are here. I screwed up on the calendar. The reason why I screwed up on the calendar is because the calendar for the academic calendar is screwy. It says that the final day for makeups is August 10th, which is next Friday. So when I saw that, I contacted the registrar back in January. I said, well, does that mean the last day of classes is the 9th? And he said, yes. Well, apparently that's not the case. The last day of classes is actually Tuesday. So what does that mean for you? Well, you're not going to have your final on Thursday. You're going to have your final on Tuesday. So that means we will not have physical class on Tuesday. The exam will be like the other exams. It will open up at 8 o'clock in the morning, and you'll have until 11:59 to complete it. Now, second, I suffered a family emergency. And unfortunately, I'm not going to be here on Thursday. I actually got to go out to Indiana, go deal with family stuff. So when I get home today, I am going to do a video that's going to pick up right where I left off. And that will be the final chunk of information for the final exam. So I will put it up there. I will activate it. And you can watch it at any point between now when I start it and I'll open it up today. Because if I don't do it tonight, I'm going to be on the plane at 5 o'clock in the morning and I'll forget to do it. So I will do it tonight as soon as I get home. So you'll have from tonight until the Tuesday to watch it. Do not miss the exam, please. I don't want to chase you for makeups. Finally, none of you are seniors, right? Are any of you seniors? All right, because I don't think anyone here is a senior. If you're working on that mega extra credit packet for the final, I will accept that from you all the way. I'll give you till Friday. Not this Friday, next Friday. Because I'll have extra time to take those in. I just want to get the papers and the grades done. And papers, you'll start hearing from me. Because of the family emergency, the weekend was chaotic, so I didn't have time to sit down. I believe if you've not submitted the papers, the deadline is tonight. So make sure you get it in.
What was the furthest back that you go back on the extra credit?
There's a pack in Engage that says super mega extra credit pack for the final. That's more than enough. So every question you answer, you'll get credit for it and so forth. You just got to send it to me as an email. All right? All right, my friends. Good luck on everything. We will hopefully see some of you in the fall. You hold on. We'll let everyone else go.
Thanks.
What am I stopping you for?